Dan Faust America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We would like to greet our new affiliate, WMQM AM 1600 in Memphis, Tennessee. That's a 50,000-watt station that is going to be bringing Mark Dan Faust America and RBN to a much wider conventional radio audience in the American South. We are joined today by Terry Arnold. He is the author of the recently published work, A World Less Safe. He is a regular columnist for Jeff Rentz, which you can find at Rentz.com, R-E-N-S-E.com. Terry Arnold is a retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. Department of State, whose immediate pre-retirement positions were as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College and as deputy director of the State Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Planning. We're chatting, among other things, about Terry's most recent effort for Rentz.com entitled Zionism and the Birth of Middle East Terrorism. And as I mentioned before the last commercial break, information on Terry's articles and his entire compendium and series at Rentz.com will be among those things that we will link to, both in the Republic Broadcasting Network archives as well as what we post on this show today at Breaking All the Rules News. Terry, we have one more commercial break coming up in about 5 minutes, and then there will be a longer period of time for more conversation. But you discuss a series of myths that pertain to this situation in Palestine in your article, Zionism and the Birth of Middle East Terrorism. The second myth that you mention is that the Zionists invented the idea and perpetrated the idea that the Palestinians left their land voluntarily. Unpack that a little bit for us this morning.
Well, the way the book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, approaches that is to walk the reader deliberately through the processes that were applied to get the Palestinian people to leave their land. First of all, a reader or a listener has to have in mind that when the Zionist takeover of Palestine began, there were probably 1,000 or so Palestinian villages. This was basically a rural economy, and the way rural economies were traditionally organized, the villages were in the heart of the farmlands that people cultivated, and that was a lifestyle. There were probably tens of thousands of Palestinians also in various small towns and villages that were not agricultural, but they were seaport related and so on and so forth. But in any event, what was undertaken was a systematic removal of the people from individual villages and the destruction of the villages. And as people were pushed out, and let's face it, 850,000 or so Palestinians were literally pushed out of their villages and homes in that 1948 period. And the villages were erased, trees were planted, Israeli names were given to the places. All of that occurred, and the result was a picture that they painted of, well, there were very few people here, and they left voluntarily. That nothing could be farther from the truth than that, and I think Ilan Pipe makes that very clear.
Yes, and when we talk about this whole thing, it seems to me that it's not simply a moral issue in regard to this ethnic cleansing of the land that occurred in 1948, where you had these 850,000 Palestinians who were dispossessed from their property. But obviously, this has been an ongoing political issue for the last 60 years, because there has never been, in my view, as I now understand this whole problem, any serious attempt to engage in any redress of legitimate Palestinian grievances. And when we come back, I'd like for you to chat with us a little bit about that, Terry. This is Mark Dan Faust America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be back with Terry Arnold of Rentz.com when we return. Stay tuned.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
People who use Cartivite know about the pollutants in our body and want them out. For over 5 years, Cartivite has proven itself time-tested. Here's Dr. Mattson, a naturopathic doctor's thoughts on Cartivite.
In our mind, there isn't such a great big mystery to disease anymore. This basic tenet of yeast in the gut and metals in the liver covers at least 70-80% of the diseases that we see. When we do our program, you know, herbal formulas like Cartivite, and you see someone who could barely walk up a hill now going for regular jogs, 2 months later, we know we're doing something right. It's a well-thought-out formula. I mean, the idea of it working on yeast and metals both at the same time and liver function is dead on. You'll find, I think, that it'll work more than just on heart problems and circulation problems. It'll work on other problems as well.
For more information, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit our Cartivite link at rbnlive.com. That toll-free number again, 1-877-928-8822.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately 1 in 4 families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Terry Arnold. He is the author of the recently published work, A World Less Safe, which you can find at Amazon. He's a regular columnist for Jeff Rentz at Rentz.com, R-E-N-S-E. You can find the Terry Arnold archive there. He's also a retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. Department of State. His immediate pre-retirement positions were as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College, and as Deputy Director of the State Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency. And among other things, we've been chatting today about Terry's article, Zionism and the Birth of Middle East Terrorism. One of the immediate recommendations that you will see if you read this article is Terry brings forth a recommendation that we take a look at Ilan Papp's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. That author's last name is P-A-P-P-E. The title is The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Terry Arnold terms it the most important work on the history of Palestine that has appeared in recent decades, and I need to bring my own education up to speed by getting a copy of that book and reading it, maybe trying to contact that gentleman as well to be on the show at a future juncture if there's contact information available for him anywhere on the World Wide Web. Terry, back to our conversation. We've been chatting about a series of myths that the Zionists utilized in this whole issue of how they conducted themselves in Palestine in the 1947-1948 time frame. We talked a little bit about this second myth that they invented, which was that the Palestinians left voluntarily. And there are a couple of interesting things that you then set out for us here. One is the fact that when the UN partitioned Palestine, they did not consult the Palestinians. They did not consider their interests. Their solution, in your words, gave more than half of Palestine, in fact, most of the best lands, to the new Jewish national home. However, the Palestinians still occupied all of it. PAP estimates that the Zionists had acquired less than 6% of the land at that stage. That obviously, it would, on a prima facie basis, would suggest that that armed conflict and armed confiscation of properties and ethnic cleansing of necessity would have to follow. And in terms of that conversation then, PAP mentions something that you talk about, and that is a plan that was called Plan D. It was apparently something conceived of at the time by David Ben-Gurion. What was Plan D?
Well, Plan D was it started by recognizing that the UN-conceived idea for Palestine was not what the Zionists had in mind. The UN's view, innocent though it might have been, was that both the newly immigrating Jews and the Palestinians would live together comfortably in Palestine. That was not what was on the minds of the Zionists, and Ben-Gurion was working to fix that. And he looked at various ways of approaching this and came up with Plan Dalat, I think is actually what's called Plan D. That was a systematic village-to-village clearing. And village-to-village clearing was not just driving the people out and taking over their homes and gardens and their trees and stuff. It was driving them out, destroying the villages, and over time replacing some of them with other villages that had Israeli markings on them and so on and so forth. This has been a long, slow process of erasing Palestinian history from Palestine.
Yes, and so it seems you have a physical removal followed by an attempt to remove any reference to any of this from history and from historical memory. And I think when you take those two things in tandem, it would be clear that eventually some things would come to the surface in regard to both the illegality and moral illegitimacy of this, as well as the fact that the people of the United States, who have, with their tax money, has been supporting these kinds of policies in Palestine, lo, these 60 years, and of course through their taxes, are in some cases now finding out that there is a whole story on this that has not been told. And the more we look into this story, it seems to me, the uglier it gets. In regard then to the way in which both of the major political parties have candidates running for president who, for the most part, are still walking lockstep, lock, stock, and barrel to the Zionist tune. What do we do in a situation politically where in this country, as our problems in Iraq and Palestine presumably continue to deepen, and as there is talk of expanding this whole effort to a preemptive war against Iran, we could run into a situation where the American people finally say enough is enough. Is this a situation where there is going to be a crisis, not simply between the political appointees, these neocon political appointees, and more responsible political and military intelligence people in Washington, but ultimately there's going to be a crisis between the American government and its people that is going to spill over into a level of protest that might even dwarf what we saw during the Vietnam War? What do you think on this, Terry?
Well, I think this is very likely to be the case because it's clear to an increasing number of people that we no longer have a two-party government system. We no longer have two distinct political parties in which when one loses and the other wins, we end up with a loyal opposition that's not loyal necessarily to the agenda of the other party, but is loyal to the interests of the American people. And I think both parties have forgotten that that's the way the system is supposed to work, and particularly the Democrats at the moment who have an opportunity to actually make that system work as a proper loyal opposition are just not taking advantage of it. They're playing the game of the Republicans and playing out their agenda. I think people are going to be increasingly unhappy with that.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, you know, I lived in Iran years ago. I've mentioned this before on the show, when my father, after he got out of the Air Force, worked for the Lockheed Company and was a logistical advisor to the Shah's Air Force for about the last 5 years of the Pahlavi dynasty before the Islamic Revolution. And, of course, I, as a young person just traveling in Iran for a series of summers, had some wonderful experiences there and have tried to read more things on Iranian history and culture in all the years since. And as I look at some of the statements that are being made out of Washington in regard to the possibility of preemptively attacking that country, and, of course, this John Hagee of Cornerstone Church here in San Antonio has been beating the drums rhetorically on his so-called Christian television network in regard to attacking that country, even with nuclear weapons, it seems to me that there are more and more thinking Americans who are looking at the way this Iraq disaster has unfolded and the fact that many of the same people who plotted and perpetrated that disaster are the same people who are advocating a preemptive war against Iran. It seems to me that if we attack that country, we're not only inviting a situation where we will be biting off more than we can chew, presumably, but you're going to be dealing, I think, with a great deal of political blowback, both in the Islamic world as well as around the world from this sort of thing. And the final, to me, the final straw that may break the camel's back is if we have a reinstitution of an American military draft in this country, because we, as I understand it, don't have the present structure, force structure, to do what some of these neocons want done in the Middle East, and we can't keep cannibalizing Army Reserve and National Guard units. If there is a reinstitution of a draft, do you think that that's the point, Terry, where more and more members of the average public looking into this will say, enough is enough, we are simply not going to support this?
Well, I would think the last straw is in plain sight if that occurs. I'd like to note at this point, Mark, that I do have a new article running on Jeff's site as of this morning.
Sure.
And it's called What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About. And what I do is look at that whole region through the particular optic of what is happening on the oil front, the acquisition of concessions in Iraq under the new oil law there, the scramble for access to the oil resources of the Central Asian region and all of that. And one of the things that I address in the piece is Iran, because Iran sits right in the middle of that landscape with access to the Persian Gulf and access to the Caspian Sea, and therefore a potentially very valuable link in the management of energy resources in that region. And what we seem to be doing is systematically trying to keep that country an enemy of the United States, and we don't need to do that. We need to turn ourselves around and work the other way.
Yes, and so it seems to me that that would be self-evident, and particularly in a context where more and more people, I suspect, have this perception that we have a Middle Eastern policy that perhaps is a continuation of the older British policy in that region that proved to be unsustainable, where between the Israeli lobby and the oil petroleum conglomerates, we've simply gotten in over our heads in regard to this whole military scene in that part of the world, where the British, as I understand it, at one time had upwards of 1 million men under arms in Mesopotamia in the first part of the 20th century. They ultimately could not cut the mustard in terms of implementing what they wanted to implement, either in Palestine or in Mesopotamia. They had to cut and run, as it were. There are those who say that the United States has simply taken up the mantle of the older British foreign policy, and we might take a look at that whole theme when we come back with Terry Arnold. And I now have pulled up on my screen What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About, is Terry's most recent effort. We'll get that article posted at BATR as well. This is Mark Antos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio on RBN. Stay tuned.
Businesses and their employees are facing constant increases in group medical insurance premiums. Employees are shouldering more of the burden themselves. Core Documents, the nation's primary source for affordable medical plan documents, has the answer. A health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA. Business owners, managers, find out now how your company can utilize a much higher deductible health insurance policy and establish an HRA to fund low deductibles for your employees. And employees, tell the boss to visit coredocuments.com now. This new HRA plan can save you thousands of dollars.
Employers all over the country are discovering how to roll back insurance costs using Core Documents HRA concept. Core Documents is the nation's primary source for affordable plan documents required by the IRS and Department of Labor for Section 125 and HRA plans. Use your insurance agent and let Core Documents help you with plan design. Do a Google search for Core Documents or see us at coredocuments.com. That's Core, C-O-R-E, documents, plural, .com.
How are you preparing ahead for the events in the future? In the near future, we know there will be those of us that will not be able to buy or sell. Stoves & More wants to help give you the freedom from the systems of the world and from skyrocketing fuel prices. Stoves & More is a dealer for all Amish-built wood cook stoves that will give you an independence you need to cook and bake your food, dry fruits and vegetables, heat your whole house water system, and heat your home. These state-of-the-art cook stoves are nothing like Grandma's old stoves. They have large, airtight, efficient fireboxes that give you an all-night burn, easily heating up to 2,000 square feet. Whether or not you're off the grid, we have products for you from stoves to Staber washers and 12 and 24 volt refrigeration. At Stoves & More, we have the perfect products to complete your preparations. To the first 10 people who purchase a stove, we'll send a free copy of our newly released DVD, Getting Started with Wood Cook Stoves. Stoves & More offers the best selection at the lowest prices on the web, so visit us at www.stovesandmoreonline.com. That website again, stovesandmoreonline.com.
Wow, that coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow. I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017, or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Terry Arnold, author of the recently published work, A World Less Safe, now available on Amazon. He's a regular columnist for Jeff Rentz, which you can find at rentz.com, R-E-N-S-E. Terry is a retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. Department of State, whose immediate pre-retirement positions were as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College, and also as Deputy Director of the State Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Planning. We've been chatting a little bit this morning about his article entitled Zionism and the Birth of Middle East Terrorism. That's a March 31st post. And Terry mentions specifically Ilan Papp's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, as the most important work on the history of Palestine that has appeared in recent decades. Switching over then to the most recent effort, Terry, which I was trying to look at during the break, what Cheney's Energy Task Force talked about. I know that that's something that has gotten a lot of play in even corporate media in the past in regard to this new oil law that the U.S.-backed Iraqi cabinet has finalized. What is, in your understanding, the essence of this new oil law, and what are the implications of it in regard to maybe stoking the fires at some point of Iraqi nationalism? I ask that question because, of course, going back to 1953, when the CIA and the British MI6 overthrew Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, presumably at the behest of British Petroleum, that whole policy came back to bite the United States and Britain a generation later. Now we're reading reports about what is going on in Baghdad with this new oil law, which suggests, as I look at the first paragraph of your article, that maybe the Iraqis are not getting a terribly good deal from these multinationals. What's your spin on this?
Well, I fear they're going to get something more like a traditional deal of the type that existed in the Middle East when I served there in the early 1960s. That was at the time of the formation of OPEC, and the reasons for the formation of OPEC were, simply put, that the oil-producing countries of that region were not getting what they thought was a fair shake on the distribution of revenues. That is what seems to be occurring again with the way the new Iraqi petroleum law has been worked out. The foreign oil company operators are pretty much on their own as to how they approach the business there. They are going to be in charge of exploration, drilling, marketing, and pricing, and all of those things. So they're going to take over a significant portion of the returns to the Iraqi oil business, and I don't think that has a high order of stability about it myself. I would give them, as some others have, a maximum of a decade for this to come apart again.
Yeah, as it certainly came apart over a 25-year period of time in Iran, and of course you add to that the disastrous policy that we have pursued in Palestine, which we've talked about in the first hour of our conversation with you, and then you bring into play this situation, and it seems to me that we're sitting on a powder keg looking at the first paragraph of your article entitled What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About. The first article says that reports from Baghdad indicate that the U.S.-backed Iraqi cabinet has finalized a new oil law that would, A, turn the development of two-thirds of Iraqi oil reserves over to foreign firms, B, give multinationals 15- and 20-year contracts, C, exempt foreign firms from the application of Iraqi law. Reportedly, a committee of three Shia and Kurdish cabinet members, plus representatives of nine foreign energy companies, British and U.S. government officials, and a representative of the International Monetary Fund, developed the new law. The new oil law, construction of the gigantic U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and development of at least four military bases in Iraq portend a fundamentally altered U.S. posture in the Middle East and Central Asian regions. You know, just in reading the first paragraph here, Terry, are we really dealing with a situation where American foreign policy in the Middle East and in Central Asia is being driven by Israel on the one hand and by oil conglomerates on the other? And if that's true, which of those two lobbies do you think is the more powerful?
I think in this particular instance, the energy lobby is far more powerful. But we have as you will find as you read in more deeply into that piece, you'll find that we have other very important interests in that Central Asian region. Those territories are largely spinoffs from the old Soviet Union, and particularly Kazakhstan was one of the places where the Russians had about 1,000 ICBMs with nuclear warheads located back in the good old days, as it were, of the Cold War. Those have now been brought under control and removed, but the region is still one of the most important areas of the world from the point of view of mining and acquisition of uranium, so that it remains strategically a very important part of the world for us. At the same time, it's got more oil than most other places on the planet outside of the Middle East.
When we come back, I want to pursue this business of Kazakhstan a little bit with you, Terry, and also talk about what the Russians and the Chinese might be up to through this so-called Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This is Mark Dankoff coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be back with Terry Arnold of Rents.com. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately one in four families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
We've all considered solar power at one time or another, and self-sufficiency will be your key to a better future. Ken Solar can help you get off the grid and become self-sufficient with solar power, and for a lot less than you would think. One of Ken's most popular items right now is the new solar power generator, for a lot less than you'd expect. This portable system can chop off nearly a third of your electric bill, a good start for any families out there wanting to get solar power for your home. Visit Ken's website at kensolar.com for free downloads, free videos, and how-tos, and of course, the new solar power generator. Use the coupon code RBN with your purchase and save an additional 10% off your order. Get a solar power generator now from kensolar.com at 239-677-3073. Again, that's 239-677-3073 or on the web at kensolar.com. Ken Solar, the home of all your solar needs.
Sit back, relax, and enjoy a vacation to the beautiful Ozark Mountains. Howard Creek Resort is nestled conveniently between the cities of Bull Shoals and Mountain Home on Bull Shoals Lake in the natural state of Arkansas. Howard Creek Resort offers easy access to excellent fishing and water recreation of all types. The excitement of nearby Branson music shows and Silver Dollar City is accented perfectly by the many attractions located here in the heart of the Ozarks. Horseback riding, water skiing, scuba diving, hiking, caves, and rock climbing are just a few of the many activities that are available to do in our area. Howard Creek Resorts offers it all. Whether you're staying for the weekend or for a month, Howard Creek Resorts is the place to be, an excellent place to stay, and a valued traditional family vacation resort. Visit our website at www.howardcreek.com or call 1-877-253-7690. Come visit us for a lifetime of memories.
Across America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Terry Arnold. Terry is the author of the recently published work, A World Less Safe. You can get that at Amazon. He's a regular columnist for Jeff Rents at Rents.com, R-E-N-S-E. He's a retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. Department of State, whose immediate pre-retirement positions were as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College, and as Deputy Director of the State Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Planning. He's written a number of incredible articles for Rents that you can find in the archives. And his new post, which is on the front page today of Rents, is entitled What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About. Terry, in regard to this whole business of of oil policy in the Middle East. I am certainly not an expert on this. I read Lutz Klaveman's book a couple of years ago, The New Great Game. I try to follow news developments in the international press as it relates to some of these oil deals that involve different countries of note. What do you make of this whole business of what seems to be a new great game for oil and natural gas reserves and pipelines in both the Middle East and Central Asia as it relates to things Russian and Chinese? I look, for example, at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and it seems to me with what I read of their news articles that come out on at least a weekly basis, that there's a lot of concern that the United States may be trying to utilize its military forces as a janissary structure to procure an inside track for certain multinationals when it comes to oil and natural gas supplies and pipelines, and that presumably some of the players in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization don't like this and would like to do some things to counteract that American influence. Do you see this as a precursor to both economic and military struggles in the years ahead?
If it's not properly managed, very definitely so. And one of the issues is truly how it will be managed in the long run. Right now, as I say in that article, the United States seems bent on a preemptive acquisition of control and access to the oil and gas resources of the Central Asian region and the Caspian Basin, for that matter. And that's an enormously powerful set of assets if they can acquire control of them, because some of the biggest potential deposits for the future are there. And the combination of Middle Eastern and Central Asian energy resources are going to dominate the planet's need for these things over a long period of time. So that I understand perfectly well why there would be a major U.S. drive on behalf of the American-led oil company majors to acquire control and access to, or at least a significant interest in, those assets. I don't have any problem with that. I think that's good, sensible energy security activity. But the question is how one goes about it, how one defends it, and how one deals with all of the oil interests of an increasing number of competing economic systems.
In terms of issues of management and mismanagement, what do you see as issues of mismanagement that could take us down the wrong road in this situation?
Well, starting Iraq, going into Iraq with the idea that the British and American majors are going to preempt access to all Iraqi oil that's newly developed from this day forward, that's pretty peremptory, and the notion that you can leave out of the discussion the Chinese or the Canadians or the French or indeed even the Russians, that's deliberately, provocatively, potentially volatile, you know, to do that. And there's no real justification for it in terms of petroleum availability and marketing, because every barrel of oil on the planet is totally fungible with every other barrel. So it almost does not matter who owns that barrel of oil, as long as that barrel of oil enters the consumer system at some point, it's going to displace and therefore balance off any other barrel of oil in the system. That's the way it works where these energy resources are concerned. And we can therefore operate this system with a good deal less conflict, potential for even warlike conflict, if we find and implement cooperative systems for managing global energy resources. We're not doing that at this point.
What do you make of some of the publicity that has that we've seen in the last couple of years, indicating that just in terms of the American military involvement in Iraq, that a tremendous amount of the money that has been spent on this, now approaching $500 billion, has been borrowed from Asian banks? If at some point, for example, principally the Japanese secondarily, decide that American foreign and military policy in the Middle East and Central Asia has simply become unsustainable, and that it's something that they are beginning to perceive as counterproductive in terms of their own interest. Is it possible that we could see at some juncture, particularly if this conflict is expanded into Iran, where some of these Asian central banks might decide to jettison American debt instruments and presumably cause a real downward crunch on the value of the American dollar? Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, I see that as a potential, merely because those countries have control of such large bundles of dollar-denominated assets. But let's face it, they're going to be of two minds about it, because in order really to jettison, they have to take enormous financial losses.
Yes.
So that what I perceive is a use of that pool of U.S. obligation as a bargaining tool in trying to get the United States to come to its senses about the way it's managing its affairs abroad. I think those pools of assets represent enormously useful bargaining tools in pressuring the United States to shape up on a lot of issues, in short.
Yes, which presumably at some point would include some backdoor behind-the-scenes pressure, I would suspect, on this whole question of the Israel-Palestinian conflict. What then in regard to your article, Terry, that's entitled What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About, which again listeners can find at rents.com, what is the International Monetary Fund angle on this, and what are the implications?
Well, the Fund and the World Bank, between them, have very real, very clear financial interests in the performance of governments around contracts such as this one. The Fund and the bank guarantee or provide loans for building pipelines. For example, a pipeline from the Chad to the Southwest African coast is now being funded by the World Bank, or guaranteed. There's lots of that activity out there, and the bank has both a direct interest in the way countries perform around such transactions. It has the financial guarantor interest in that, and it has the economic development interests of those countries in the long run also on its agenda. So the interest of the IMF and others in these transactions is perfectly legitimate. We would want it if it were not occurring.
What in terms of this whole issue you raised about the so-called colossal new embassy that has been created or is in the process of being created in Baghdad? Meanwhile, as you point out, the Pentagon is busy fleshing out, in your words, at least four major U.S. military bases in Iraq. Does this not suggest that the American military presence in that country is going to continue at a fairly large level for the foreseeable future?
Well, it certainly suggests that that's the American design, but I detect in the behavior of such Iraqi groups as Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi Army and so on, that they would rather not see that come about. So there is an enormous possibility of conflict being built here, probability of conflict between the United States and the Iraqi people that's being generated by these activities on the part of the United States. And to me, personally, as a longtime diplomat, creating a diplomatic facility that's completely surrounded by a 15-foot concrete wall and is meant to be self-sustaining, in which the people on the inside rarely, if ever, have any interactions with the people of the country, that would be a long-term offensive provocation. And I think that's the way it will be viewed.
Well, I have read some of Muqtada al-Sadr's recent statements in regard to the United States and its presence in Iraq. Are we looking at a situation where the Shia side of the ledger on this, and al-Sadr's Shia faction in particular, will engage long-term in a series of terroristic activities against the American military presence in that country that are designed presumably to strike at our economic assets and to wear down domestic political support in the United States for what has been transpiring in Iraq. Is that pretty much what you see as al-Sadr's game plan? And to what extent are the Iranians, in your view, working in conjunction with al-Sadr to ensure that this campaign does take place?
Well, first of all, I think although al-Sadr and his family traditionally have had fairly close connections with Iran, and that's reasonable because the base of Shia Islam is Iran, after all. My sense is that most of Muqtada al-Sadr's activity is going to be locally directed against the American forces, and he doesn't actually need a great deal of help from the Iranian people. He's pretty darn well equipped, and he's going to get an increasing recruitment pool if the U.S. response to what's going on there continues to be repressive. You know, make life as easy as possible for the insurgents to recruit new people. That's what we seem to be doing now.
Well, because of your background, Terry, you obviously would know a lot more about this than I, both the political side of it as well as the military side of it through your days at the National War College. I have read some of Pat Buchanan's articles dealing with this whole business of asymmetrical warfare. I'm trying to remember what Pat said in regard to what the accepted American military dogma is now in regard to the ratio of conventional troops that you need for every insurgent that exists in the country. It might have been 10 to 1, I don't recall.
It's more likely 20 to 1.
Let's call it 20 to 1. Okay, that makes it even more depressing than what I already started out.
It is depressing. It's quite depressing. I have a piece in the Rents file on that one, too. So.
Well, I'm going to dig it out and read it because I know with your credentials, I'm very interested to see what you would say about this. So let's say that the ratio is 20 to 1. I'll accept that at face value because of the person who's saying it to me. If the ratio is 20 to 1, and we're dealing with a situation right now where we've got, what, give or take 150,000 troops in that country?
Close on to that, I think, given the backward returns and the so-called surge, it's something like that. The changes are not very big and they're not very fast.
Right. Well, considering, of course, the grim character of this 20 to 1 ratio that you postulate here, which, again, I would accept at face value because of the source, how many insurgents, from what you're hearing, how many insurgents does American intelligence believe are operating in that country, and how many insurgents do they believe have been recruited in recent years for these efforts? I mean, I remember seeing a thing, I think it was Paul Bremer, I believe, who said a few years ago that American intelligence believed that there were 5,000 insurgents in the country. A year later, that was revised to 20,000, a factor of four. Who knows how many there are now? What is your best guess or educated estimate as to the number of insurgents that we're talking about in that country who, at the behest of al-Sadr or any other leader or faction, will be directing activities against American military and economic assets there?
Well, it's very hard to get a number on this. If you take only Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army, that could run 5,000 to 10,000 very easily. That does not count any of the Sunni insurgents in the Anbar province in that region and around Baghdad. It doesn't count the Peshmerga forces of the Kurds in the north. You're looking at indigenous insurgent qua paramilitary forces in a range that could go as high as 50,000, you know.
When and presumably that 50,000 figure would be a combination of Shia, Sunni, and Peshmerga Kurdish forces?
Yes, it would. They wouldn't all be on the same side of any given question either, but
right.
what they would represent collectively is a contribution to the overall instability of the Iraqi landscape. And I think that is the challenge for us, because that overall instability issue is what drives our train there.
And so if we take, again, that infamous 20 to 1 ratio and do some multiplication here, We come up presumably with an American military presence in Iraq that would have to be many times larger than it is, I would imagine, to deal with these issues.
We come up with a situation in which American forces there are ridiculously outnumbered.
Right. And where presumably the opposition is assessing the domestic political situation in the United States, where all of the available numbers show plummeting support for what is going on Iraq on the part of the administration, and for that matter, what the Congress is supporting the administration in at this point. Does this not suggest that two real pressing problems that we have in our present Iraq policy, one is a force structure that is not adequate to do the job given this this 20-to-1 ratio that you cite in terms of soldiers, conventional soldiers needed for numbers of insurgents, but where we're also dealing with presumably al-Sadr's perception and the perception of Kurds and Sunnis as well, that the U.S. is having a case of waning of collective political will, much as it did during the Southeast Asian conflict in Vietnam a couple of generations ago. If they're perceiving things that way, A, do you believe that that's a correct assessment on their part? And B, if they are perceiving that correctly or incorrectly, does it not suggest that they will be in this for a much longer haul than maybe many of our people have imagined up to this point? We'll cover that when we come back. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We have today Terry Arnold, who has been talking to us about a series of things related to Middle Eastern policy. You can find Terry's articles at rents.com, and we'll be chatting with him for a few more minutes when we come back. Stay tuned.
Wow, that coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow. I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017. Or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
Summer is once again just around the corner, and as usual, so are higher gas prices. This year, stop taking it on the chin and start fighting back. Ethos FR, a product tested and found worthy by NBC and Fox News, can save you up to 19% on fuel and reduce emissions by up to 30%. Unlike other products and gadgets you've seen advertised, Ethos FR attacks the source of the problem, unburned fuel. You see, exhaust is essentially unburned fuel that's expelled from your tailpipe. That equates to toxins being released into the environment and dollars being released from your wallet. But with Ethos FR, fuel burns more completely, helping your engine to deliver better mileage and helping you to save money. And it's so easy to use. Simply pour a couple of ounces into your tank at every fill-up, and you're on your way to saving money and the environment. So, do yourself and the environment a favor and visit ctsavegas.com to get your bottle today. That's ctsavegas.com.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com. your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
Mark Antos America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today has been Terry Arnold. He's the author of the recently published work, A World Less Safe, which you can find at Amazon. Regular columnist for Jeff Rentz at Rentz.com, R-E-N-S-E.com. Terry is a senior, retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. Department of State, whose immediate pre-retirement positions were as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College and as deputy director of the State Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Planning. We have been talking about a couple of his articles today for Rentz. One is entitled Zionism and the Birth of Middle East Terrorism. And then, of course, Terry's current effort for Rentz, which is entitled What Cheney's Energy Task Force Talked About. These articles and links to them will be posted today in my description of this show for Breaking All the Rules News. We will also, when the RBN Network archives this broadcast, we will make sure that all of this information about Terry Arnold with links to his book and links to his articles are posted directly at the RBN website. Tomorrow I'm going to have another USS Liberty survivor on this show, John Hrankowski. John hails from Rochester, New York. You can find the USS Liberty Survivors website at ussliberty.org. We have had, of course, Gary Brummett on the show, Commander Dave Lewis. We had Phil Turney of Colorado on the show last week talking about some of his experiences. John Hrankowski will join us tomorrow. And you can find that USS Liberty website at ussliberty.org. Terry, we have a ridiculously short period of time left for you to engage in a prophecy. In regard to Iraq, Iran, and Palestine, give me a one-minute summary, perhaps, of where you think things are going with American foreign policy in regard to these three areas of the world as we are moving into a presidential election season. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, Mark, I think we have to reassess our goals in all of these situations. Our goal in Palestine has to become an even-handed effort to see to the interests and rights of all of the people involved there, and we've got a long way to move to get politically to that point. In Iraq, we have to recognize that we're not dealing with just routine problems of terrorism. We're dealing with fairly systematic problems of insurgency on a part of a nation's people who honestly do not want us there. And I consider it smart on our part to recognize when it's time to take our troops off the battlefield and move the discussion to the political arena. It was Clausewitz who coined the term that war is diplomacy by other means. The insurgents seem to understand this a good deal better than we do, and it's about time we caught up with the curve on it.
Yes. In regard to Iran, do you think we will have a war with them in the next year, or do you think that saner voices and sounder minds will prevail?
Well, my opinion flips about a little bit on that, but I think as of now, we're moving towards something more sane than a pitched battle with the Iranian people, and I think that would be very smart on our part because it's an enormous problem if we decide to take it on.
So your reading of that situation is that at least a few of the political and military professionals in Washington have maybe been able to convince the Bush-Cheney regime that they need to rethink some of this business.
I think that's true, and I certainly hope it is, because that would be the way to go.
Yes, that's certainly my reading of the situation. When I, of course, I'm not an expert on Iran, but I lived there years ago, and I think of a country of 70 million people, where over something like 70%, I guess, of the population is under 30, and when I look at the political will of the Shiites and the performance that Iran had in the 1980 to 1988 conflict with Iraq, as well as what Ahmadinejad has said will be the resolve of the Iranian people in the event of a Western attack, it seems to me that with what we're already dealing with in Iraq and Palestine, that a move into Iran, which I don't support morally, or politically, I think would be